With the NBA playoffs coming back, something we're going to be seeing a lot is every player's fresh new cut. But you know what else needs a fresh new cut? Your lawn. That's why you should hit up Tavon's Lawn Care. Tavon's Lawn Care LLC is a black family-owned business located in York, Pennsylvania. Tavon's Lawn Care, or TLC for short, since they provide each job with tender love and care, has been in business for over 10 years. Founded by owner Tavon Parker, TLC aims to provide employment for underprivileged youth while providing great service at a reasonable rate. Visit Tavon's Lawn Care LLC or Tavon's Lawn Care on Facebook and Instagram to view their portfolio and request your cost-free quote today.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to episode 18 of the All In Podcast. I'm your co-host, Eli Cooper. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Badzik. How's it going, brother?
Going good, man. 18 episodes already. This is flying by, man. I'm excited about this one, though.
Yeah. As you guys can see, if you're watching on YouTube, we have a special guest in the building joining us today. Guy from my hometown, York, PA, and former NFL player and offensive lineman and Division I football player, Richard Muldrow. My guy, how you doing?
Doing good, man. Blessed to be here. Thank you for having me. And just blessed. That's
all I can say. Yeah, man. We appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so today we figured would be a good day to get into some NFL topics. Some big news came out with Cam Newton signing with the Patriots to a one-year deal. So we're going to talk a little bit about how that impacts the Pats' chances and things like that in the AFC. First, we're going to do a little interview so you guys can get to know Richard a little bit better about, you know, his career and things like that and what he's got going on now. So first thing we want to get to is we're going to talk about, you know, your high school. You played high school football at York High, correct?
Correct.
Yep. So, you know, and at that time, you know, for those listening in, like going Division I out of York was rare back during those times. It's become a little bit more popular now. Like football in York has become a lot more talented. I think a kid from Central now is like one of the top QBs in the country or, mm-hmm. you know, so – it's evolved a lot, but it started back when you were in high school and out of high school, you committed to Rutgers University and one of your teammates as well, Greg Gaskins, had committed to Pitt. And that was like huge news in our area back then because it was such a rare accomplishment. So talk a little bit about, you know, the struggles that it took just for you to get there, you know, what kind of, you know, work ethic you had to put in and things like that.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, you know, everybody has that goal and that mindset to go Division One. You know, when you touch the football field, my story is a little bit different because when I first came up through the sport, basketball was my first love. You couldn't pull me off a basketball court. I devote a lot of my time and my effort to the court. I would say the life changing moment for me was going to Penn State and meeting Joe Paterno, God rest his soul. That was my junior year of high school. And, you know, it was just like, wow, this is what Division I football has to offer. You know, just going and getting that exposure, Beaver Stadium, all the people. And, you know, for him to know who I was, that was a life-changing moment. So what I would say is it's you know, when we were coming out, you know, York County football had that reputation, you know, of not being very strong and not having a lot of people come out of that area in a long time. Because even, like, before, it was a lot of good people that came out. So we had like Will Beattie in 04, Knowledge Timmons, you know, but then, you know, and there's plenty more that came out before that. But we set a trend. It was just putting in the work ethic. It took me until my junior year to really finally get it. I actually went to York Catholic before I played for York High. I went there for, you know, from 7th to 10th grade. So that's a traditionally big basketball powerhouse school. So you could see that was embedded in your mind. But I guess what helped me too, man, being 6'7", over 300 pounds with a little bit pinch of athleticism, I mean, that helped me in my recruiting effort. But you got to work. I think that's where a lot of people get sidetracked is just the amount of work you got to put in just to get noticed. It's very, very, it can be stressful. But then at the end, it could be rewarding and then it can be annoying. Because there was one point, the phones were just coming, like when it's getting closer and closer to commitment and signing day, the coaches were just calling and calling and calling and calling and calling. It got annoying after a while. But I'll just say, just the process, everything's a process. And I mean, I'll explain more as I go through my whole lineage of college sports, I mean, of football. It's a process. So the work ethic you got to put in is crazy. You know what I mean? And now that was, we're talking, what, 2005 to 2007? The game has changed so much now where they're starting to look at kids in like seventh and eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just, you have to put in so much work. I know me, just being a big guy, you know, having to eat a certain amount of calories, lift, run, get in shape. That was a lot harder for me back then, you know. And, you know, just having a support system. A lot of kids, you know, don't have a support system. I was fortunate to have both my parents, you know, pushing me. My mom was a former D1 athlete. My dad was a coach, football player. So that helped. But if a kid like me out of New York City, you know, doesn't have both, you know, both parents involved, it could be a little bit harder. But it could also be helping too, because you have that push.
Yeah, so, and then you kind of talk about the process there, and it wasn't always maybe as you planned. So out of high school, you end up at Rutgers, and then you redshirt your freshman year there. And then the next 2 years maybe weren't exactly what you envisioned. Kind of talk about the experience at Rutgers, and then ultimately that led you to move on after that.
Okay, so coming out of high school, I mean, you're the man. You feel like everything is on top, you know. So, I mean, I was offered by Penn State, West Virginia. I remember West Virginia back then, I mean, just up till recently, I think they're still doing well with a powerhouse. Boston College was turning linemen out left and right. So when you're getting recruited, you're getting all these big-time, you know, big-time letters and everything, it kind of like you got to get like that big head mindset. And my head's already big enough. So I would say, first of all, I'm going to say why I chose Rutgers, okay? And, you know, the reason why I chose Rutgers was, you know, I wanted to be a part of something that was starting to build a foundation, you know, build a legacy, build a foundation. Rutgers was up and coming. They just had that really crazy year with Ray Rice and Brian Leonard when they beat Louisville on ESPN. That attracted me to go there. Also, if I was a regular student, where would I get the best overall college experience? The diversity of the campus, the closest to New York and Philly. That's why I went. So when I got there, first and foremost, you got to get broken in. You got to get humble. So I had to get my weight in check, had to get in shape. Had to get my body right, because, you know, I came in 320 something pounds as a threat that wasn't going to cut it in college. You know what I mean? I had to get, you know, what I mean by that, lose the fat, build the muscle back on. So I was making a lot of good progress when I first started out there, redshirted, you know, came into the spring too deep, was making a push to play. And just in turn of events, man, just, you know, simply just got outworked, lost my opportunity to compete for a starting role. My first redshirt year, so that was what, redshirt freshman year, redshirt sophomore year, starting to make another push. I get hurt probably in the middle of the season. I tore my meniscus. So it was just falling in and out, you know what I mean, of the depth chart, you know, not really cutting it, you know. And it wasn't my work ethic, but I always had a strong work ethic, always. That's one thing about me. Whatever I do, I go 110%. Same with academics. It was just at that time, you know, you either gotta piss or get off the pot, you know. And, you know, I was, you know, traveling, made it to the two deep. And then it's just, at this point, it was just, I was stagnant. You know, there was no progress being made. And there's a lot of things I can do to get, you know, there's a lot of things I would say, as I tell every young athlete when you go to college, you know, opportunity, you always have an opportunity to get better at what you do. So, for example, some days I had chances to get better. On the weekends, you know, instead of me going into work, doing extra work in the facility, I would go play basketball. But I'm not there on the basketball scholarship, you know what I'm saying? Right. So stuff like that, you know, you always have a chance to get better. You know, and some of my teammates be like, yo, Joe, man, let's work on kick sides, one-on-ones, pass rush. And at that time, I'm like, nah, man, I'm going to hoop. We do football in the spring. I'm going to go hoop. But that's the difference between being a starter and being a guy, you know, getting in mop-up time, you know. And basically, you know, that's just what happened. I lost my opportunity to see the field. And, you know, coming down to my redshirt junior year, it was a decision I had to make, you know, stick it out, see what happens, or move on from it. And I decided to move on from it.
And so talk a little bit about that balance between, you know, your academics and Division I football, because – I don't think a lot of people know exactly what goes into that, you know, especially when you're at, you know, at the time Rutgers football was, like you said, it was on the up and up. So it was becoming, you know, one of the bigger name schools in college football. So, you know, talk a little bit about how difficult that was and balancing academics and things like that.
Key thing is time. I would tell any student, anybody going to college, time management.
Yeah.
Something I learned when I was growing up is just to be organized with time, being aware with awareness of time. It's balancing your time because 5 a.m., we had something called fat walks, you know, so 5 a.m. I was up, right? And I had to go and walk on the treadmill for 45 minutes. And this is before workouts, okay? So you're thinking at 5 o'clock, bam. Then you get about a 5-minute, 10-minute grace period where you get yourself together, and then you go to workouts from 6 to about 8. Then you got to hurry up and get – you got to hurry up and take a shower and get the breakfast before 8:45 because you got to check in with your coaches. Because at Rutgers, they had a nice system where all of our coaches would eat breakfast with us in the morning. And we would bring our – we would have a time management sheet and a book. And we would bring our books to the coaches and say, okay, don't you have a paper due this day? I'm like, well, why do you write it down? Like, how do you know this stuff? Because they used to talk to our academic advisors weekly. So you had to balance that. Okay, and I'm just talking about during the season. So – you know, you had the fat walk, workouts. This is my redshirt year. Fat walk, workouts, eat, and then you got to go to class. Now, all of our classes, they will have them set up early in the morning, or you have them later in the afternoon, evenings, because we have practice dead smack in the afternoon. So you go to class. Maybe I got two classes back to back in the morning. Then I got to get over to the facility, and they usually have. If I had time to eat, I would go to one of the dining halls. Rutgers was huge, so we had 5 of them. Go to one dining house, get a quick lunch, get over to the facility. Or if I'm running real lack of time, I will put in a request for a box lunch. Then you go there, and then you got to get taped and braced before meetings. So you got to go in there and get taped, get braced, meetings, practice, dinner after practice. And sometimes if you had a class that you had to go on the other side of town to get to, because I told you, Rutgers is here, you get a box dinner. By the time you get home, oh yeah, not to mention study hall. You had to get 8 hours a week.
Yep.
So by the time you get home, it's damn near 11, 12 o'clock at night. Okay. That's the time you get home. Get up and do the same thing over again. So let me tell you, man, it was a little rough, at first. And I won't say because I wasn't prepared. It was just getting used to getting up early and getting moving. Like, oh my goodness, gotta be here. So, you know, and meeting deadlines, you know, now I went to Your Country Day in York, you know, so I was prepared for the academic rigor of what was being pushed because I took college classes and everything like that. But it was just the time management, man. It was so much stuff we had to do.
Yeah.
You couldn't really be a regular student. Like when spring came, that was like the winter and spring. That was like, yes, I can finally breathe a little bit.
Yeah. And see, you know, so I have the privilege of playing, you know, Division II basketball, and it's not nearly as intense as that. But that was like I had a rude wake up call my freshman year too. I think everybody that's why like it's really hard to get on the floor or get on the field as a freshman because you really just have no idea like what you're running into. And I think, you know, I'm in coaching now. So my biggest thing that I push to players is like, if you think it's crazy, you're not cut out for it. You know what I mean? That's kind of the mindset you have to have. Like, if you think 1,000 shots a day is crazy, like a day is crazy, then it's not Division I basketball is not for you. Leave it alone. If you and I had a high school gym teacher who played college basketball, you know, and was on our staff for in high school, who told me I needed to run the mile in under 6 minutes. I thought he was crazy. I never ran it under 6:45 when I was in high school. I thought he was crazy. I was like, 6 minutes? You know how hard you have to run? No way. You're crazy. I honestly laughed it off. I got to college, and every morning, 6 a.m., we had to be on the track, and you had to run the mile in under 6 minutes. So, you know what I mean? He was really trying to tell me something that I needed to know, and because I thought it was crazy, I was not prepared. My freshman year in conditioning was awful. And ask any of my teammates. really bad. But it's just, you know what I mean? And after that, though, you know, I took it way more serious when I came home from school after that. Like, that entire summer that I dedicated myself to going back and never having that conditioning, you know, be as much of an issue again. So, right. You know, that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. Like you said, everybody wants the Division I thing. That's like everyone's goal, or just to play college sports in general, and they have no idea what it actually takes. Like, if you have a lazy bone in your body, you're in for a rude awakening. So that's certainly true, regardless of what level you play at, but especially at the Division I level.
Yeah, and in the Big East, this is, you know what I mean?
Like, this is tough back then.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
That joint was tough. Yeah, it was tough.
So then you talked about you had the 2 years at Rutgers, and then you said you kind of had to make a decision of, do I want to ride this out, or do I want to maybe try somewhere else? Of course, you ended up going somewhere else. So did they approach you? Like, how did that happen with Richmond?
So this is before – they don't have a transfer portal. So it's crazy because, let me tell you, it's humbling because you're like, man, you never think you're going to transfer out of a school. Like, I never thought I was going to be transferred. I thought I was going to be playing on, you know, Big East, playing on the big stage. You know, I never thought – so at first it was hard to fathom. Like, damn, I'm really transferring. Like, now how do I feel about this? You know, I'm like, damn, I really didn't crack it. So I filled a long list of people who went D1 and didn't make it through. Okay, but I'll tell you, man, it was pretty much, you put out a list of schools we wanted to transfer to, you know, and I put down like Temple, you know, because Temple, you know, they were an up and coming program, but then my coach was saying like, hey, man, you're only gonna have 1 year to play because you got to sit out a year when you transfer another Division I institution back then. I don't know how it is now. So what I did was I just basically put out a list and I was looking at, okay, where am I going to get the one best education? Because that's number one. And two, you know, where I'm going to fulfill, you know, being able to play, you know, still at a higher stage. So I put in for like a lot of the CAA schools, the Big South, like the Appalachian States, places like that. And Richmond, I mean, I visited Richmond. I visited Liberty. Old Dominion was up and coming back then. And they actually ended up being really good when we played them. But they reached out. And Richmond, it was just a perfect opportunity, man. I went down there, you know, I'm like, I'm going to school in the South. So it's like a culture shock a little bit, you know, just it's a lot different down there. As you can see what's going on modern day times. Yeah, Monument Avenue is real. That's real. but long story short, I just felt at home down there. The coach was a brother named Latrell Scott. He said, look, man, we need linemen. I think they just came off a big playoff run. It was a year after they won the national championship in 08. That final year, I think they lost in the semifinals. He said, look, man, I'm losing. I think they were losing like three or four offensive linemen. So he said, I need linemen one. And he said, man, we just got this bad transfer from USC. So I'm like, USC quarterback. And I'm like, oh, snap. I read up on him, Aaron Court. And I'm like, Aaron Court, man, he was starting after Sanchez and tore his leg up, and that's when Matt Buckley came in and took, and he ended up transferring. But he was starting right after Sanchez graduated. So I'm like, all right. And I one of my visits down there, I met a brother named Martin Parker, who was an All-American at that time, who ended up going to play for the Giants with us. But, you know, they brought me in, hosted me, and I sat with Aaron and talked. He was like, man, we need linemen. You know, and then I just fell in love with the campus, man. Small, private liberal arts school. Yeah. You would think it'd be like this big, big school, but the big, big school is VCU down the street. But it just felt at home. And, you know, I was going to have the opportunity to come right in and play. And I was having, you know, they play an ACC opponent every year. So we started off with Virginia. So I'm just like, hey, where do I sign, coach? You know,
yeah.
I'm willing to come down and play. So that's how I fell into Richmond pretty much.
and we're going to talk – I do want to talk about your time in Richmond because obviously it was very successful. But yes. So then, of course, you know, after Richmond, you go to the Arena League and you have some NFL time. I'm sure that in high school and even when you got to Rutgers, you're thinking to yourself, I want to have a chance to go to the league, right? You probably, you know, even if you don't know for sure, you're thinking, my goal is I want to play in the NFL. I want to do this. How was your confidence levels? You know, I'm sure coming out of high school, you said you're the man. You think, I'm definitely, I want to do this. And then at Rutgers, I'm sure it probably took a little bit of a hit. And then you transfer to Richmond, which, it, you know, as you said, up and coming. They had a lot of guys coming in. But it is, you know, a D2 school opposed to where you were in Rutgers. So let's talk about, like, kind of the mental balance of going from a Big East school to Richmond and how that played with your head as you're trying to make the NFL? Kind of a loaded question.
No, that's not a great question. It's let me tell you, coming out of York, coming out where we're from, and, you know, and I know Eli can, he can attest, you know, a lot of people have high expectations. They have higher expectations for you than you have for yourself at times. So you feel a lot of pressure, okay? And, you know, we're a small city, small town, central Pennsylvania, you know, overshadowed by, you know, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania a lot. You know, you have like that thing, I gotta make it, because kids look up to you, the people, you know, your people look up to you. It's just so much pressure. So when I was transferring, you know, that stuck with me a little bit. It's like, dang, you know, I might not make it, you know, I might not get an opportunity, you know, and it does play with you mentally a little bit, because you feel like you fail. You know what I mean? Like, dang, man, everybody think, why are you transferring for? Why, you know? And it's like, man, you know, I kind of blew it, you know what I'm saying? So it hits you for a little bit, you know, but then, you know, as you grow and you see, you know, one thing I wish I would have knew is NFL, if you're good, they're going to find you.
Right.
Okay, yep. No matter what level of football that you play on. But everybody gets, you know, you get hyped up and being on in the spotlight. You know what I'm saying? So at first it was tough mentally to fathom, like transferring. I'm like, man, I feel some type of way. But it easily went away when I stepped on the field against Virginia, you know, and that, you know, Virginia, the Cavaliers, I was just like, bam, okay. I know I can play at this level, you know, because I went in there and I played very well. You know, we lost, but we gave him a hell of a game. That was actually one of the best games I ever played in. Nice stadium, nice grass. It was awesome. But you know, you see that you belong on that level. You know, yeah. You can play on that Division I level. So it went away as time went on, and you know, you start having a little bit of success at Richmond. So it went away. Yeah, it was tough at first, though. I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's a good point, man. Especially you know, coming out of York. It is a little bit different because, like, you know, see, people see you do big things and then, you know what I mean, they expect that. But it's also, I think it's important for kids to understand, not just from New York, but really from anywhere. Like, there's nothing wrong with being the big fish in a little pond. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of kids make the mistake of committing to conferences and schools and not programs. You know what I mean? And not coaching staffs and schools. You know what I mean? Like, where you're actually, like, getting an education from. Where, like, do you even enjoy that school outside of the sport that you play? You know what I mean? So I think that's important. And I think, you know, a lot of times you have to learn that the hard way, you know what I mean? And things like that. So, you know, maybe Rutgers wasn't the fit that you wanted it to be, but you got exactly what you needed out of Richmond anyway. So, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I think a lot of times those kind of things end up being a blessing in disguise.
Definitely. And it's crazy you said big fish in a small pond. The coach who recruited me, he was transitioning out and he was leaving. He was like, hey, man, go somewhere and be a big fish in a small pond. He said, man, we hate to see you go, but, you know, go somewhere and be a big fish in a small pond. Because the crazy thing is, man, I love Rutgers. I was involved off, like, with NAACP. I was involved with Black Student Union. I was very heavily involved there outside of football. So I really did enjoy it. I had a lot of friends, football players. You know, we had that family bond that, you know, you ever heard about, you know, Coach Yana over saying, forget about me, I love you. Still live to that, you know, still sticks with you. You know, I can call my buddies from Rutgers, hey, what y'all doing? You know, I live up here in Jersey now. So, you know, it's still that brotherhood's still there. It's just you had that goal, that thing you want to, you know, that pedestal you want to reach. So you had to do what you had to do.
Yeah.
But absolutely. I got some advice for that too. we'll keep going.
So, obviously, you know, had a very successful, you know, 2 years at Richmond and, you know, like you said, NFL found you. So talk about your process leading up to the draft, you know, where you know, had your like pro day, your workouts, your things like that. Talk a little bit about that.
So Richmond, it was successful in a sense. We didn't, as far as our team goes, we didn't live up to the expectation. It was injuries. We had an issue with our coach my senior year where he ended up, you know, having to, you know, resign from his job. I mean, it was a lot of things that played a factor in it. I know my senior year, we started off hot. Beat Duke, at Duke. We started off 3-0, and, man, we were in a slump. Guys were getting hurt. We were losing games, but like no more than 7 points each game. Wow. 3 points, you know, real close. So we ended up going 3-8 my senior year. You know, so I come out, you know, scouts, you know, you hear from scouts, you know, people coming in, talking to you, watching your film, you know, coming to watch you. And when it's a crazy thing, man, when these scouts come, they look at everything you do, the way you stretch, the way you warm up, the way you walk, right, the way you talk. I mean, they're on you, like they're on you. So my process isn't the prototypical dream process of getting there. First and foremost, you know, I have maybe about 2 or 3 agents reach out, you know, where some athletes have the boatload. I trained at a place in Pittsburgh. Mike, you might be familiar. I was living in Bridgeville. Power Train, Steve Saunders.
Yep.
I forget the location, but I was training there with some good guys like Nate Stupar from Penn State, Gino Gradkowski, who went to West Virginia but transferred to Delaware, Don Barclay from West Virginia. So we had a really nice class in there. We actually got a lot of good work in. So I trained there for a couple months. I did a pro day at Richmond, and I did one at Rutgers. And I actually did really well. I ran like a 5.10, somewhere around that range. I was lean. I was in the best shape of my life, man. Tested well, benched, I think it was like 21 reps and 225. And, you know, people were talking. You know, I talked to the Jets. Who else was it? It was about 5 schools. Teams. Jets, Raiders. I had a private workout with the Raiders. Jaguars, Cardinals. And there was one more I can't think of. I think it was like the Buccaneers. Oh, no, San Francisco. Somebody around that range. Mm. So it was feeling real, real good. Okay, and that was the process leading up to the draft. Man, I'm going to tell you, second worst time is draft. Let me tell you, man. Because you know you ain't going first 2 days. I knew right. I wasn't going first 2 days. I'm being real with myself. You know, third day, far reach, but free agency, okay. I think I got a shot at getting a free agent deal. So 3 days passed, man. It was very stressful because, you know, you had people calling like, yo, somebody called me from a San Diego number. So I'm like, this is the third day. I'm like, yo, is this the Chargers? Oh my. Pick up, hello, yo, bro. Anybody pick you up there? I said, man, who is this? I was so mad. So, man, let me tell you, it was tough. So, I ended up getting calls from the Raiders, Jaguars, Jets, they're coming from minicamp, and I said, where, you know, more than likely somebody's going to sign me, you know. So I said, you know, I'm gonna go that route and try out for 3 different teams. But I ended up only just going to one because I went to Oakland. Because I did a private workout leading up the draft with Oakland. So I go to Oakland, and you get there, man. And this is how I wrote it. Let me tell you how I wrote the free agent lifestyle. Not even being a signed free agent. This is how real it is. They might have about 4 spots that they want to add to their active roster for the summer. Okay, you got about 30 to 40 people who are there on a tryout basis for those 4 spots, okay? Not to mention, you also got 4 guys who've been in the NFL who might have got cut or who might have been on practice squad trying to keep that spot, okay? So you're competing not only with the other 40 guys for 4 spots, but there might be, like when I got there, one of my old former teammates from Rutgers was there. Ed Wayne, who played for the Bills, he was there. So I'm competing with guys who've been in the NFL for a lineman spot.
Right.
Not to mention the guys that they drafted who they're going to put a lot more stock in and put the more, you know, they got time to make mistakes and things like that. So me as an undrafted free agent, the minimum chance for error is like this, okay? It's like this. And, man, when you get there, I mean, the playbook's like this thick, all right? They tell you, boom. So you get in there, and they didn't have the iPads back then. You got the old school 3-ring binder with the play, yeah, with the plays in there. You need to know inside zone, outside zone, bam, 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 the calls, everything. And man, when you get in there, you got to spit information, bam, bam, bam. So it was just picking that up, you know. And I did pretty fine with that, you know, competing, working hard. It's just when they say being in the right place at the right time, having the right opportunity at the right time, that's what it was. Ended up not getting signed. Okay. And that was, you know, at first I'm like, okay, I'm young, I got time, things are going to happen. man, it was just like a spiral effect. You know, teams calling, oh, we might bring you in. No, we're not going to bring you in. You know, boom, boom. It was just like, wow, this is stressful. So I went out there for mini camp. And then, yeah, I was at a funeral in York. And my agent calls. He's like, yo, man, you gotta pack your bags tonight. What do you mean? He said, man, I just got off the phone with New England. I'm thinking like, okay. This is like right before camp, July. Okay. He said, all right, they're going to pay for you to fly. They're going to fly you out. You know, they fly you. That was a nice thing. They flew you out everywhere. So you had the best seats. Everybody knew you were somebody because you sat up in the front row or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, and, you know, like you had New England. So, man, when you get to New England, I was trying out for the final lineman spot between me and a kid from Oregon, okay, who had just got cut by, I forget who he got picked, Vikings. He was in the Vikings. He had just got cut by the Vikings. They read it out. They gave him a red-eye flight. He got in at 4 o'clock in the morning and went straight to the facility. We get there, man. It's like I can't even tell you, man. It's Gia. I mean, Kraft wasn't there. He probably was watching from a view. But everybody, like in the personnel department, scouting department, was there. The offensive line coach is giving you the workout. And they're just – I mean, it's like they're watching you do everything, stretch, run – and the workout was hard as hell. I mean, it was an hour of just pure grinding. I mean, and, you know, you're trying to make it. So, man, I'm trying to get in front of my man from Oregon. Right. Trying to jump in front of the line. You know, I'm trying to stick out like a sore thumb, you know. Then the worst part about it is waiting for the decision. Okay? Waiting for the decision. We go get a physical. I sat in the Patriots locker room for 2 hours, waiting to see what's going on, who they going to sign. And I didn't realize how real it was, and I'll explain it later because I was going through a transitional period because obviously I didn't get signed by New England. That was a bummer, man, because that was a nice place. Gillette Stadium, everything's right there. Gillette Stadium, everything's right there. I ended up going on like a 2-year hiatus. I was working at Target. Now, I got a college degree. Working at the East York Target, stocking shelves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, people tell me I gotta move with more urgency because I felt like I don't belong here. But I'm trying to get to the next level. So I'm going to do whatever it takes. I got to work out and stuff. I'm gonna get up in the morning, go stock these shelves, make this $200 check a week, biweekly, and keep it moving. So after New England, I got a call from Canada. Now that was a dope experience. I went out to Calgary. I was out there for 6 weeks filling in for somebody who was, because they have like the American Canadian rule. Okay. So I was filling a roster spot for the American who just got hurt. As soon as he was recovered, I was back in America. That's how cutthroat it was. And it was, you know, you ask why, what's the reason? Numbers. That's all they can tell you. They can't tell you about your play. They can't tell you about your practice effort, nothing. Numbers. It's a numbers thing. You got to have a certain amount of Canadians on the roster, a certain amount of Americans. So after that, man, I went into like a funk a little bit. Like my grandma just passed. I was trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do. So I went and I got a job at Target. NFL, nobody was really calling. So I get a call to go play arena football down in New Orleans. And New Orleans, as far as the football, like the team, horrible. Like we had a lot of talented guys from LSU, former NFL players. I mean, we had some talented people. But we couldn't mesh together as a team with the coaching staff and the players. But the experience just living in New Orleans was awesome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I never trade that for the world, man. I live down there, you know, Bourbon Street is everything corrected to be. I got this nice party going. But, you know, it was just one of them things, man. You know, I had success and I would get opportunity. I would, like, I actually ended up coming home and taking a teaching job, a substitute teaching job at Helen Thaxton in York. And I got a call to go to the Redskins during the season. Again, man, you get there, it's crazy. You get there, there's three guys who've been in the NFL already that you're competing with to get a spot on that roster in the middle of the season. Okay, so there's no room for error. You got to do something that sticks out. You know what I mean? But I was always like, man, every time I go down, every time I go somewhere, I'm running the guys who've been in the NFL. And I'm trying to outwork them, outplay them. But it's just like, man. You know, here's five other linemen I'm competing with.
Right.
And that gets you mentally. It does. It's like, okay. So, you mind if I keep going? I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah, go ahead.
That was 2015. That was 2014, 2015. So I went back to Arena, played another year in New Orleans, and it was very, very quiet. You know, my coach from Arena is like, hey, the Titans are going to come watch you play, the Saints, nothing. Come back home. I my grandma passed on Illinois. You know, I went to Illinois for about a month. Come back. I take a substitute teaching job in York City schools at Ferguson K-8. So can you imagine me working day to day with kindergartners to eighth grade? So at that point, man, I was starting to make the transition out of football. Like, I was just like, you know what? It's not really working, you know, in my favor. But I still continue to train. So 2016, April, Carolina Panthers want to bring me in for minicamp, and that was my final straw. So I went to Carolina and, you know, did an interview. They had a video feature showing me blocking the sled, doing drills. Feeling good, man. Like, uh-oh, is this my break? They didn't take me. I can only play left tackle. Guy they took can play three positions. He could play guard, center, and tackle from Cal, and he was a rookie. So here I am, a 27-year-old, pretty much 27-year-old rookie. You going to take a 27-year-old rookie, or are you going to take a 22-year-old rookie? And I can honestly say I never fulfilled my dream of playing in the NFL because, you know, I got close. I put a helmet on. You come to the locker, you see a name. You see a name on the back of a jersey. You got gear in there galore. You got, you know, you feel it. And, you know, I never fulfilled that goal of making it as a player. So when I say that walk, and my girlfriend, who's my fiance now, you know, big ups to her because without her, man, I was a wreck. That walk in Charlotte Douglas Airport was the longest walk of my life from when they dropped me off. First of all, they drop you off in class. You know, they drop you off in a nice big UConn Denali XL. it was full of guys who were trying to get to the league, man. And I'm just sitting around some of the guys who got cut with me, and they're like, man, I don't know what I'm gonna do, man. I don't have a plan, man. I don't know what I'm gonna do. Like, it was depressing, man. It was a long, long, long walk from there to the gate, man. And I'm actually now looking back at it, I'm extremely thankful for it, and I'll explain more why as we keep talking, because I obviously end up switching pathways, but. You know, that was a tough couple of years after college, man, because you're thinking 6'7", I can move, I'm strong, you know, I can play this game, I'm going to get a shot somewhere. And that's not the case. I got a shot, but I never got to fulfill playing, you know. And, it, you know, it, it's, you know, it hits you sometime, but you tend to move on from it.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, that's still – an incredible like experience, you know what I mean? That right. most people don't get to even tell that story, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, to me, I think that's a success in itself, even if you never really get to, you know, end up on the field, you know, just to have the opportunity to even get there to me is cool enough, man. So, you know, big ups to you, especially coming from, coming from where we're from, that stuff is difficult, man.
The pressure's there. Yeah, it's there. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, you know, you kind of, Carolina was kind of your last straw, like you said, and then so what did you transition into next, you know, into like post-career stuff?
So I laugh at Tony because, you know, if I tell you I was gonna be a teacher, you know, that, you know, it's in my blood. My grandmother was a long time educator in New York City, you know, in the school district. She was assistant superintendent, so it was bound to happen. But I ended up actually going up to Harrisburg. I got an opportunity to coach and teach at Harrisburg High School, John Harris campus. Calvin Everett, who's the head coach there now and athletic director, you know, presented me with the opportunity that, you know, you just couldn't pass down. So I ended up going into teaching. I first started off as a computer science. It was like a long-term sub position, but I was there for the whole year. Computer science, career pathways, just to get my feet wet in the district. But my degree is in history and a minor in Africana study. So I got into teaching, man, and coaching, and, man, it was just like the light bulb clicked. Bam, you know, like, oh, I'm starting to like this. You know, I'm really – because at first I was like, I'm not here. I'm just here to get it, you know. I'm just here to, you know, do what I have to do and get out because I know I'm going to get an opportunity to go play somewhere. But now that my career was over, I gave 100% commitment to becoming an educator and becoming a teacher. And, I mean, you know how Harrisburg is, you know, Harrisburg City. You know, yeah. same demographic background as York. A little bit bigger, but the same issues, you know. Mm-hmm. And I found my calling. I really did because, you know, you start, you know, having an effect on kids more than just sports, you know.
Yeah.
Some kids didn't have that male role model, that real, you know, male father figure, you know, to show them the right path, and, you know, and I took that role, you know, and then coaching football, I mean, if you guys have been reading up on Harrisburg in the past couple of years, it's been a hell of a ride, you know, it's been a hell of a journey with the success and the amount of people going to college. And if you guys follow, you know, Penn State football, you know, probably the top linebacker is coming out, you know, it's going to be coming out, you know, mm-hmm. from there, you know, at Penn State. So it's just interacting with that, man. And I found my calling, man, teaching, you know, I can't really explain it. It's like a surreal feeling, man. Cause you know, I've been all over the world, you know, and football's taken me so far, but my greatest reward is being able to come in and talk and teach kids, you know what I mean? And just be that positive role model. So I went into that transition, and that's why I'm currently doing, going into year six.
Yeah, man. And that's, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk about was, cause that, I think that's really important, especially being, you know, a young Black educator. I think it gives you, at inner city schools, it gives yeah. kids something to look at as far as like different options. You know what I mean? Like a lot of kids coming up from the city, they think they got to rap or they got to, you know, play ball to get out. And that's not always the case. And, mm-hmm. you know, even though you got had the opportunity to play, you know, college football and even a little bit professionally, you know, you still have a degree and, you know, something that you can fall back on, you know what I mean? Where all your eggs weren't in that one basket, you know what I mean? So, yeah. And that's something that I think is important for kids to be able to see, like, dang, this is someone who, you know, whether you're a student athlete or a regular student, you know, you can see someone who got to go through the process and, you know, play at a stage that, you know, that people rarely get to, but then also comes back, gives back to his community and, you know, and ends up being a face that they don't get to see a lot. Especially like when you think about inner city schools, which are predominantly Black, how many Black educators are there in these schools teaching these kids? You know what I mean?
Right.
Which has been one of the biggest problems in our community is that kids don't even have educators that they can relate with. And then there's teachers who don't really even care about them. Like they're not even happy that they're at those schools. You know what I mean? They don't relish in those opportunity to shape and mold kids growing up. They look at these kids as another statistic. Whereas now they get the opportunity to see someone who came from where they came from, you know, or a background from where they came from and, you know, made it out and didn't have to struggle and didn't have to play in the NFL to be successful, you know? So I think that's important, man. And big ups to you, man, for taking that on, because I think that's something that we have to put a lot more pride in the Black community is in our educators.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's how you say that, Eli. That's the thing. Like when we, you know, we think, you know, that's the only way out, you know, and you know, it's natural. Cause you know, you see that glamorous lifestyle. You know, yep. you see like these guys getting the big contracts and, you know, you see how they pull up in nice cars, stuff like that, you know. And sometimes for them, that's a rewarding feeling. But I'm telling you, man, like, I'm only going to grow in this profession. You know, I'm going back to school to get my master's degree in leadership. So I want to be like an administrator, you know, and eventually lead a district someday. So, you know, starting off becoming a principal, you know, supervisor, principal, and, you know, getting that administration role. So I'm going back to school this fall to get my master's. But yeah, that's just we all think that we have to, you know, it's that pressure that we got to make it, you know, but there's so much more to it. And my example, you know, I was telling like a lot of guys who I coach, you know, one of my guys who I coach is going to be going to Penn State next year, offensive lineman. And, you know, it was just cool to just share that experience with him and tell him like, I've been there, I know exactly what they're looking for. I know what they're looking at. But just telling them, you know, telling all the players, you know, in my position group and who I taught, you know, the more, you know, you got to stay woke. You know, you got to take your academics serious, because just like that, an injury, you know, a missed opportunity, it can be taken from you just like that. I said, here I am, 6'7". Now, you know, I taught, you know, I'm big, you know, I taught him, Eli, 6'7". And, you know, and I got all this size on me. And I'm sitting here talking in front of y'all. And I'm not out blocking with Cam Newton. You know what I mean? And I said, but my purpose is not made, it's not for football. I mean, be on the field. My role, you know, my purpose isn't there. It took me a long time to realize that. And once I got over that, I said, I have a greater cause. Maybe, no, I'm not playing, but I'm preparing the next future NFL star. You know what I mean? And I'm keeping him socially aware of what's going on in society, so mm-hmm. he knows how to protect himself, you know, from police and things of that sort. You know, so that's more rewarding than signing a multi-million-dollar contract for me. You know,
yeah.
And I never thought I'd be saying stuff like that, but, you know, I'm gonna work hard. I'm gonna get to what I'm gonna get to, because you don't get rich in this profession. You're not gonna be making million-dollar contracts, stuff like that. But the reward is the lives you touch.
Yeah.
You know, and the people who come back and say, you know, thank you, Mr. Marjo. You know what I mean? You were right, Mr. Marjo. You know, I see what you're saying now. You know, that's the greatest fun. Hey, I graduated from school. Like some of the kids I had back in 2014 when I was when I first started teaching, I graduated from college now. You know, some have families already, you know, and they're working hard and doing well. You know, so it's just like, wow, you know, you touched a lot of lives than you thought. So that's what keeps me going in this profession, man, honestly. And, you know, do I miss playing sometimes? Yeah. Sometimes you watch, you see a lot of them get beat. It's like, oh, I can get paid a couple million to get beat like that. You know what I mean? Here, sign me right now. Go ahead. Yeah. You're a Giants, you're a Jets. I'm right here.
Yeah.
But it's a rewarding feeling being able to educate, you know, be an educator. And, you know, where I'm at now in Newark, New Jersey, you know, one of my favorite people in history is Malcolm X. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's a dream, but it's, you know, it's, who would have thought I'd be teaching at Malcolm X Shabazz High School? You know, never would have thought, you know, and, you know, it had Newark as it's probably, you know, it's rough and it's a little wild, but at the same time, it's a blessing because you're, you know, I'm doing something that I love. So, yeah.
That's awesome, man. Well, we certainly appreciate that, man, for real.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about current NFL topics. You mentioned Cam Newton. Talk. Good time to talk about him. He just recently signed to the Patriots a one-year veteran minimum for a former NFL MVP. Richard Sherman was not a fan of that on Twitter. But let's talk about, one, do you think he stays there, you know, remaining the season? Like, does he end up winning a starting job? Do you think that's reasonable for him?
Man, it depends on his health. I follow social media, so you see him online working out and he looks like he's ready to go. I think he's playing basketball with Ty Gurley and Quavo. But everybody knows it's different on the football field. Honestly, it's hard for me to say. Who do they have right now? They got who? Jacoby Brissett and
They got Jared Stidham is lined up to be the starter. He was, at least before they got Cam. Now it'll probably be a competition.
Yeah, Jacoby Brissett's not on there, is he? I thought he was.
No, he went to
Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Indianapolis. But Phillip Rivers is there. Okay, so.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's ready to go, I can see him getting in there and getting that starting role. I mean, at the end of the day, that's a former NFL MVP. Who is actually a very smart football player, and knows the game really well and plays the game really well when he's 100%. What I think is going to come down to is if he's healthy, you know what I mean? That's the number one thing. And it's just, like I said, the opportunity. It depends on what they're trying to do, because everybody, I always hear that rumor. Were they not? I mean, I can't see the Patriots tanking a season or, you know, selling out their season to get Trevor Lawrence, because everybody knows Trevor Lawrence is coming out. That's a bad boy. You know what I mean? Yeah. So everybody's saying, because you see Trevor Lawrence in a Patriots uniform. So it kind of explains my reasoning for that 1 year. But honestly, 1 year contract for him, I would say is unacceptable. because just a former NFL MVP, you got backups getting more money than he is right now. You know, backups who might have played for injured roles for, you know. So it's hard to say. I guess my correct way of saying it, time will tell.
Yeah. It's tough with him because he's got the shoulder injury and the foot injury. You know, so you worry about the throwing shoulder. I don't know. I think that will probably heal, but the foot injury because he runs a lot. But, like, you know, people say that Cam's inaccurate. Well, I don't think he's that inaccurate, actually. Once he went to the pro-style offense, North Turner came in, the offensive coordinator. He actually was really accurate. He was really good. And so I think that he'll be okay in a Patriots. I think they were just like, the Patriots are like, well, what's the worst that could happen? We'll sign him to a one-year vet minimum. There's a lot of incentives in it. So, like, if he is the starter and he takes him to the playoffs, he'll get paid a lot more than a vet minimum. Yeah. But you would think he'd beat out Jared Stidham for the job, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And it's crazy that you mentioned that, like, and when he had North Turner, he had, in my opinion, less talented receivers.
Oh, yeah.
I won't say less talented. They were young. Yeah, they were very young. Like, the boy, what's his name, from Maryland, Moore, he was fumbling a lot that year.
DJ Moore, yeah.
Funches was dropping passes left and right.
Yeah, yeah.
Greg Olsen was hurt. But you got some up and coming receivers. I mean, you got Julian Edelman out there still. But you got like N'Keal Harry, who's a pretty good receiver. You know, he got some people.
Sanu, Mohamed Sanu. Mohamed.
I forgot about Mohamed.
I was going to say, it's your guy, right?
Freaking nature, bro.
Definitely, this will definitely be the best offensive line he's ever played for.
Yes. Yeah, they come. That was a tough. He had a tough sledding, especially that Super Bowl. But I mean, anybody going against Von Miller, that's tough. That's a tough matchup, regardless who you are. But I mean, I think he'll be all right. You know, it's just time will tell. We got to see what goes on with this pandemic. You know.
Yeah.
No, I hear rumors. People want to go to maybe moving football to the spring. Who knows? We don't know.
Interesting.
That's the talk out there.
I mean, could be. They might have to if people don't start wearing a mask. Karen, put your mask on. let's say fully healthy. You know, everybody starts wearing their masks, so pandemic's not an issue. Are the Patriots a contender in the AFC now with Cam Newton?
Oh, no.
No?
Nah.
So still not a threat to the Ravens, Chiefs, so-and-so, everybody else?
Nah, man, that boy DeSean Jackson's a bad boy. Pat Mahomes is a bad boy. Will they make the playoffs? What are they in the AFC? They're in the AFC
East.
Yeah.
So they're not up there with like the Bills and all that.
They got Buffalo, Jets, and Dolphins.
Yes, they'll be fine.
Bills now have Stephon Diggs. So,
they'll make the playoffs. I would say
playoffs for sure. I don't know if they win the division. I think the Bills are pretty strong. We'll see what Josh Allen has, but I think I don't think they're quite necessarily a threat to.
Kansas City and the Chiefs,
to the Ravens, Chiefs.
Yeah.
Even Mike Steelers, if Big Ben is still healthy.
I like that, Eli.
Okay, fair enough. So next NFL topic we got to get into is cap. I think it's hilarious that we're now looking at Kaepernick as a we're finally seeing Kaepernick in the light that we've known it forever. But bit about how the NFL has flipped a little bit right now. They want to be on the right side of history, apparently, 4 years later, still haven't acknowledged the wrongdoings of Cap. So if he gets another shot and it's something that they've talked about, would you bother taking it if you were him?
If I were him personally, no, I would not take it. And I think I made a post on Facebook about this. Cap is right where he needs to be. Now, what I mean by that is he's been bringing it to our attention since, 2016, of the injustice and inequality of people of color in the United States. It's been going on for 400 years, okay? If I'm Cap and I get opportunity, because they could have gave him opportunity for 4 years now, Okay. And that workout he had was, I don't care what nobody say, that workout was that was like a publicity thing. Not for Cap, but like the NFL saying, we're making the effort to give him opportunity. But at the end of the day, they didn't, because they wanted him to work out of a facility. He didn't want to work out. Or what was it? He wanted the cameras there and they didn't want cameras there. I think that's what it was.
They didn't want, they didn't want cameras there. That way, when he looked great, they could say, well, he didn't look good, so we didn't sign him.
There it is. Thank you, Mike. And if I'm him, there's no need for him to go back and play football. He's got, I mean, he's had that big deal with Nike. He's making a major impact on a philanthropy level and a social movement level that I think he's covered. Now, what I think they should do is probably give him a role like somewhere in that front office, okay? And not in the front office, in the headquarters, the NFL. Right. Like some type of opportunity, you know, in the NFL, like front office type deal. But as far as playing, I wouldn't go back because, you know, it was plenty of opportunities. He was still doing pretty well, you know. And he wasn't, and the thing is, he wasn't disrespecting. That's when people come, you know, the issue is they say, oh, you're disrespecting the flag. He wasn't disrespecting the flag. He was kneeling for what is going on right now as we speak, and that's the injustice and the brutality of the police on people of color. And we're starting to see all these cases now come up. You know, George Floyd, that was, you know, the tip of the iceberg, but it's been going on for long. And it's not even, and the thing is, I mean, it's you know, you obviously you're going to point the finger at the white police officers, but then I've seen in certain places too, like in Baltimore, Freddie Gray, you had people of color taking part. Minnesota, the one officer was a person of color. So it's a whole, you know, it's a whole overall institutionalized thing that's going on with, you know, with the police and people of color right now. It's been going on for 400 years. You can't replace history. You can't, I mean, you can't replace what took place here for 400. Okay.
Right.
And that's the reason why he's doing what he's doing. And the thing is, a lot of people in the NFL, players included, didn't support his cause either. You had a lot of guys in there that were still standing for the flag, saying, oh, Cap is maybe being the distraction, you know. And now they all realize, like, man, we should have took a more important stance on this. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, and there's a book out, and I haven't read it yet, but I've read, like, reviews about it, $40 Million Slave. It makes a lot of sense because a lot of these guys didn't take action because they were worried about their status on the team, their contracts. Mm-hmm. They might get cut, you know, because some of these owners, hey, man, you're going to stand for the flag regardless. I don't care what the cause is. You're standing for the flag and you're not going to play. You know, and that's what you're seeing. So some guys were seeing sellouts, and Cap was just trying to – what he was doing was giving us a preview of what was yet to come. And now it's like, ha, I told you so. You know, that image of him taking a knee is so – you see the connection now with the officer knee on George Floyd's neck. You know, that's what he was trying to prove. He said, Al Sharpton said in the eulogy, take your knee off our neck.
Yeah.
And that's what's been going on.
Yeah, man. And that's really the crazy thing is, you know, obviously Cap started this movement 4 years ago, at least in the NFL. Like people knew, you know, most black people knew about this issue beforehand. He just brought it to everyone's attention 4 years ago with his stance and started a real conversation. And I guess, you know, in a way, I guess he had to be the guy to fall on his sword and sacrifice his career, because obviously things have to get uglier before they get better. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, 4 years later, we look back and the people who now side with the Black Lives Matter movement has doubled, according to like recent studies, which is, it's interesting, man, because I've seen it myself just from people back that I went to school with. You know, I went to Northeastern, which is still arguably one of the most racist areas in York. And it's like really subtle. Like the one of their principals in one of the middle schools or something like that called Black Lives Matter a leftist lie. So it's still an issue. But like I had kids that I grew up with who I'm trying to explain what he's doing to, who didn't understand it 4 years ago. And now I see them like posting stuff on Blackout Tuesday and like being allies. And I'm like, dude, like I tried to tell you this when he was trying to tell you it. And it's like, okay, you know, whatever, however long it took you, it's fine. You're here now and that's cool. But it's like, it's just sad that when you look at it, like Cap had to lose everything for the last 4 years maybe not everything, because Nike kind of took care of him and things like that. And yeah. honestly, mm-hmm. he's done much bigger work in the community not playing football than what he could have. But like, it's sad that we didn't get to see the rest of his prime because, you know, some racist NFL owners blackballed him. Simple as that. Yeah. And now they want to paint it that they're on our side. Like, I think you need to do more. Like you said, I think, yeah, beyond playing. Put him in this, okay, you did this thing with Jay-Z. Like, replace Jay-Z with Colin Kaepernick. Like, Colin Kaepernick has way more knowledge on the subject of systemic oppression and can help the NFL do whatever they can to help it way better than what Jay-Z can. No disrespect to him. But, like, that's impactful change where they can kind of be like, okay, you know, we messed up. Here's what we can do to fix it. Can you help us fix it? You know what I mean? Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea rather than him, you know, coming back and playing.
Yep.
I was just going to add, like, let's be real about the NFL here too. You know, them coming out now and saying, we welcome Colin Kaepernick back. We understand his name. Well, you didn't just figure it out. He told you 4 years ago what he was doing, but you know, 35% of the country supported the Black Lives Matter movement, and now 70% do. And now you look at the numbers and you say, okay, it's profitable for us to bring him back to be on the right side of history here because we see the trends in the society that are going that way. So that's why, if I'm Kaepernick, I say, screw you guys, because I told you what I was doing. I told you what this was about. You didn't want to know back then. So don't tell me you know now, because you know now. I think you're just pandering to what you see going on, and a lot of it has to do with the president. Obviously, you know, back in 2016, he came out very strongly against the Kaepernick. Now, you know, and now he kind of almost has the same tone the NFL does, where they asked him, you know, should Colin Kaepernick be back in the league, and he was like, well, yeah, if he's still good enough to be quarterback. Well, like, let's be honest, the question was never is he good enough to be a quarterback. I mean, you can question whether or not he was good enough to remain a starter after his last season, but there's no question that he would have been at least at a minimum one of the best backups in the league. So I think, and it's something I tweeted the other day about ESPN, because ESPN is doing all their Black Lives Matter stuff and all the NBA stuff. You know, but 4 years ago, the anchors and the sportscasters who put those messages out there, you silenced them. You silenced Jamil Hill. You silenced Michael Smith. But now you see which way the society is going, which is a good thing that people are changing their mind. But, you know, I'm much less lenient on a corporation as I am a person. A person, you know, an average citizen, you can see differing messages. If you're on Facebook, you might see a fake news, something that pushes you one way, or then you see something else, you push another way. If you're a corporation, if you're worried about the dollar, you're looking at it from how many people are on this side, how many people are on this side, right? And then they're changing their view as it fits them financially. So that's why, like, I get annoyed with the even ESPN now, who's doing all that stuff, and the NFL, if they want Colin Kaepernick back. If I was Cap, I would tell them, you know, you had your chance. Now you're going to have to go down in history as the league that blackballed me out of the league.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said.
Well said. Totally agree. Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's just, you look at the NFL, and just being in there, just seeing it, man. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that meets the eye. Like, it's so appealing, man. You get, I mean, you got the resources out of the world, but like, at the end of the day, you got to play for somebody. You know what I mean? You're a form of entertainment. Your money, your name, your brand brings money to the league. You know what I mean? Yeah, you get paid for it. You know, certain guys get paid. But, like, at the end of the day, you know, when you want to stand up for something that you believe in, you know, your First Amendment right and, you know, your rights that the Constitution says that you have, even though the Constitution, I think, wasn't written for people of color. that's just right. My thoughts, you know, being a historian and studying history. But it's in the print. You know, it's in the National Archive. But when you see that and you see these owners and the way they're responding, it's just kind of like feeling like, well, what am I to you? Am I just a slave? Am I, you know, am I a form of entertainment? You mean to tell me I have these rights and I can't exercise these rights? And I'm not even disrespecting, because you had plenty of people in the military that said, I'm siding with Kaepernick.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. He's not just, you know, I'm siding with him. You know, you have people coming from doing tours in Iraq and all them places like that saying, hey, man, we agree with everything he's doing, you know. So he's not disrespecting the flag. He's more so kneeling for a cause. And a lot of these owners are like, well, if you kneel, you're done. It's, you know, and that can, you know, being somebody that might come from Compton, California, you know, mom, you know, father's gone, mom, you know, your mom is your only, you know, your only source there, you know, mm-hmm. and you're living, you got a family, you know, you're going to say, all right, you know what? I know this is wrong, but I got to make this money because I got to eat. My family got to eat. Mm-hmm. And then you got somebody like Kaepernick, like, man, the hell with this. This ain't about the money right now. Even though, like you said, he got taken care of, you know, Nike gave him a nice little deal and everything. It's about what's coming down in the future, what our generations to follow could experience, you know.
Yeah.
And all these events is happening, and now it's changing because this is what he told us 4 years ago, you know, but yeah. Now it's changing now. And it's crazy, you know, you said 35%, and now 70%, man. A couple weeks ago, I was in New York City. We just like, we're like, hey, we're going to ride over here and just check out what's going on. You know what I mean? I like doing the protest type stuff, but with the COVID and all that, you know, you're kind of scared. First of all, I only live about 20 miles from New York. So, it's scary as hell to be going in there. Right? So I said, you know what, let's go. Put a mask on. And it was just amazing to see. There were a lot more Caucasian white people than there were people of color at these rallies. And I say, man, the world is changing.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you still have African American, but this is now a national, this really is real. Like, I took my phone out and recorded. I'm like, man, there's a lot of white people here. And I was like, wow. Whereas in the 1960s, it was primarily just African Americans with a few, you know, Caucasians sprinkled in. So a lot has changed. And yeah. it took all this stuff to happen. And now everybody's like, wow, we see what you're saying. You know, people are getting fed up with it. Yeah. But the NFL though, they're dead wrong for that. They should have been siding with him from day one. Because 70% of your clientele, 70% of your employees are black.
Yeah.
Right.
And high percentage. And it's great that you mentioned, you know, the players had, you know, their fears and stuff. And I think a lot of that was coming from Trump, right? Because remember,
yeah.
Trump was the one that came out and said, you know, oh, if you see the, how great would it be if the NFL owners were like, get that SOB off the field and all that stuff. And I think that rang true to a lot of these owners who were scared of him. And then, yeah, obviously that trickles down to the players. But then this time around, that video of Saquon Barkley and some other Mahomes. NFL players capped off by Patrick Mahomes, your defending Super Bowl MVP, who is one of the, you know, few black quarterbacks in the league, is at the end showing that he's a part of the movement. Now, like, that is what gave the players their power back. You know what I mean? That's the kind of like, you know, hold on. We got the face of your franchise on here. Now you need to listen to us. And then that's when the NFL is kind of like, okay, you know, now, the Wonder Kid is on their side. Maybe we should tune in because we can't afford that hit. So it's like, and I think, but people know Trump, I think it's pretty, it ain't over yet, but it's almost a foregone conclusion that Trump's on his way out. Like, he's just, he's like, I mean, we still got to get out there and do the job, obviously, but like, it's looking bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's literally, he's tripping, he's falling, he can't get up at this point. Yeah. And I think that fear of, you know, that Trump had over the owners is also going away. So they're a little bit more lenient. And also you have, you know, Mike's point as well, as far as like the dollar side of it. So,
and I'll tell you what's going to be, what's going to play a major factor too. We got to get the president, but where we really got to get the voting is in that Senate. That's where we that's where we got to make the change. Because you see the Senate now, you are starting to see a lot of people say, you know, especially with this, like, the pandemic really exposing the ugly side of Trump and, you know, and company.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the stuff he was getting on TV saying, like, inject yourself with bleach and UV lights. I said, my fiance said his hair looks like, you know, a cotton candy machine. You know, when it's I want to go on TV and see if I can pull his hair off and see if it's real, and see if it's a piece right here in the middle. But no, but I think we really got it, because even when Obama was in office, I mean, Obama didn't have the support from the Senate. You know, right. them senators in there, like, what's my man's name? Not Mike McCarthy.
Mitch McConnell, yeah.
He got to go.
He's the Grim Reaper, yeah.
He is the Grim Reaper. Like, you look at the history of the United States, and, like, this brings you back to Richmond. You drive down Monument Avenue, that's what it's called. Man, the first thing you greeted by is a statue of Robert E. Lee, and it's huge. I mean, it's huge. You know, that thing is huge. I think they took it down. Then you got, like, Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis. So you're talking about the capital of the Confederacy, okay? And that's in the heart of Richmond, the capital of Virginia. So just imagine, and they're saying, well, we can't remove history. It's part of our heritage. No, if you study history, the Confederacy was against the Union. The right. Union was the United States. The Confederacy wanted to keep slavery and, you know, whatever their political views were. But the main thing was to keep servitude, okay? And why celebrate and glorify the symbols, the rhetoric, you know, all those soldiers, all those generals, Robert E. Lee, all of them had slaves, okay? They all had slaves. And some of the Union, you know, some of the Union had slaves too, yeah, Michael. But the Union, at least you have people in the Union who were fighting to end it. You know what I mean? Like, it was wrong. It was not the right thing to do. You know, let's be done with it. And when you drive in Richmond, you feel it sometimes. You can, in certain parts, in certain pockets. I mean, it's for most parts predominantly black. The city is predominantly black, but the surrounding areas is you see a lot more Caucasian. And some people don't know the war is over down there. You know, same when you go to, like, South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, and places like that. You know, they got places like. There was a place called, and I don't know, the last time I've been there was like 2011. They had a place called Tar Babies. And the picture of the baby was a pickaninny. And that was a, you know, a real dark skinned baby in blackface. And it's called Tar Babies, and people are going there to eat. So,
oh, wow.
You know, yeah, I want to think that they changed the name by now.
Yeah, but that would make business sense.
Look at Mississippi. You know, look at the Confederate flag. Like, you go to any other country, let's go to Germany, for example, you don't see nobody flying a Nazi flag. Uh-uh. Okay. And the crazy thing with the swastika, the thing is that what I studied, the swastika was actually like a peaceful symbol at first. It ended up being, it was Hitler that changed the philosophy of the swastika. But if you look up the history of the swastika, it's really not supposed to be a hatred symbol. But Hitler made it that way. So you go to Germany, ain't nowhere in Germany you see a swastika, unless it's in somebody's house, if they still believe in it, you don't see a Nazi flag. Whereas you come to America, hell, you come to York, PA, and you go out there in Manchester and Dover and places like that, and you got some jokers driving an old school Ford F-150 with the Confederate flag on the stickers in the back of their
crazy
on the back of the truck, and you see these signs, the South shall rise again.
Yeah.
So what is that? If I'm somebody that sees South shall rise again, the South shall rise again, what are you saying? You know, like the song, Dixie, the land of Dixie, look down south, down south in Dixie, I wish I was in the land of cotton. That right there tells you the ideological view of that flag. Ain't nothing about Southern pride with that flag.
Nothing.
No.
I mean, even if you looked at you're a history guy. You look at the articles of Confederation, and you compare them to the Constitution. It's the exact same document. They just added, "We will never ban slavery." To say that the Civil War or the Confederate flag is about anything besides slavery is just a lie.
Yeah. And honestly. You know, I love when they use that excuse, Southern heritage. And then, like you said, I drive outside of my house for the last 18 years, and like half the time I will see at least one Confederate flag. And you're in a northern state, so it really and hardly any of your family's from there. But okay, we want to call it Southern heritage. The Confederacy lasted 5 years. There's no way that's not heritage. Like that, it was there. Lady Gaga's career has lasted longer than that. Like, come on. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no way that that's a part of your heritage. You know, yeah. It's just what it's BS. It's a lame excuse. And people are like complaining about the monuments and like, oh, well, you can't erase history. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Is taking down a statue erasing the history of what Robert E. Lee did and how wicked he was? No, we still know. We're just not idolizing him anymore with the statue. That's all. Like, it's not, it doesn't mean, oh, because the statue comes down, oh, who was Robert E. Lee? No, that's not how it works. Like, we still understand his role in history. We're now telling you how bad it was.
That's what museums are for.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you could still go to a museum and learn about Robert E. Lee. They're still going to teach it to you in history class because it's important. Yeah. So it's not like it's lost. We're just not going to idolize him with a giant statue anymore and make Black people kind of like, you know, feel like this statue is like, no, don't forget you in the South. You know what I mean? Don't forget where you at.
That's what it felt like, man.
And that's just kind of, it's just like, no, you know what I mean? Like take all of them down. Bring them all down. Because not to mention, these are the same people that fly this flag who call themselves patriots. How can you call yourself a patriot? These people were traitors. Why under the American flag should any of these traitors, they literally separated from the Union, they committed treason. Why are we idolizing them with statues? What country does that? Like you said, there's no Nazi flags. Those Hitler and his people were traitors. In Germany, they're ashamed of that stuff. You bring that stuff up, they're like, yeah, man, that was an awful time in our country's history. They all frown upon it. But we have like idiots and losers who claim to be patriots flying a Confederate flag, trying to make all these excuses for anything but it being basically you telling everyone that you're a racist. That's what it is.
And that's just the country we live in. You know, like you said, we have the freedom of speech. You have the freedom to do whatever you want to do. But like I said, you know, don't, you know, and to hear our president get up there and say that, like, he made a reference. He was like, yeah, I think he was talking about like the Black Lives Matter and people. This guy got up there and said, Frederick Douglass. He said, yeah, there's a guy named Frederick Douglass who has done some great, really great things. And continues to do great things. Bruh, Frederick Douglass has been there for over 100 years. So that tells you right there. Yeah, he didn't even know who Frederick Douglass was.
Right.
Yeah, come on, man. Leave it alone.
He didn't even know what Black Wall Street was. So it's that, stuff like that. But he remembered about the Confederacy and Robert E. Lee. And, you know, and yes, like you said, Mike, that needs to be, that we need to learn about stuff like that. Put it in the museums. Because if you study war strategy, you study war history, Robert E. Lee was a bad man as far as a general. I mean, I'm not going to take nothing away from him as far as a general. He was actually a really good, you know, military leader, especially what he did prior to Civil War. But at the end of the day, he stood up for something and he supported something that took a person and made them less than what they were and made them subjective to the ideology. I say it's been a long day. Made him suggestive to what America viewed for them was. He was trying to keep that going. Yeah. At the end of the day, that's wrong. Simulation, that's what I'm looking for. You know, you assimilate somebody, strip them from their culture, their religion, their language, and you bring them to the land that they don't know. They ain't going to be able to go back because they had to jump in the water. You know, we weren't making it through the water. And you change everything about them and you brainwash them into believing that this is the right way. That this is what the, you know, they put in religious aspect. This is what God wants you to do. And you don't give them any credit for it. You know what I mean? Your way of credit is punishment and intimidation and maybe a few scraps, you know. Mm-hmm. And it started from there, from 1619, all the way to 2020. Still goes on. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're not in chains and all that, but there's a lot of stuff that's been going on between then. Yeah, we have some monumental, you know, accomplishments. But that overshadowing, like I think it said, Malcolm X said, you know, if I stab you in the back with a knife, okay, and I stab you in the back and you move it slowly, you think that's progress. That's not progress.
Right.
That when you pull the knife all the way out, that's not progress, okay? Because the progress is being hindered by the wound, and the wound is what's hindering the progress. So you think about American history, you think about what's going on. Yeah, okay, you take slavery, right? yeah, there's progress, right? We obviously, African Americans have more opportunities. You know, we're the desegregation of schools, first black president. I mean, there's so much you can talk about. Progress. But then you got the wound, and that wound is huge, and it's slowly but surely bleeding out, where you're going to soon have a mass extinction. So what's the mass extinction? You talk about the prison system. You talk about black on black crime. You're talking about all this stuff that's going on right now in our country. That's what he was saying by that, by progress. It's the wound that we got to heal. And that wound is the ideological teaching of slavery, of hate. That's the wound. And if we don't fix that wound up, it's going to be a revolving door. We're going to keep having these Black Lives Matter protests. Nothing's going to be getting done. I mean, now things have gotten done, but you know, you're still having an issue with police. Look what happened after George Floyd. Literally, a couple weeks after, that man in Atlanta gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, am I saying is he was trying to go home, even though he was drunk. He said, man, my sister lives right down the street. Let me just walk home. I'm going straight home. Okay. Yeah, he wrestled and tussled with the police. Right. Gotcha. Understand. He shot the taser gun. Everybody knows once you shoot the taser, you can't rekindle and shoot it again. Once that thing shoots out, it's done. And you learn that in the academy. So why, when that man is running, his back turned, and he has no gun on him, you pull out your gun and you shoot 3 shots in the back? Makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's what I mean by the wound. The wound is so deep, man. It's deep. Right. There's no problem, you know. You're not making progress as you think.
And that's and exactly what you say, like, just there, like, why would you shoot him in the back? Well, I think, like, it's a bigger question of why do you even have a gun in the situation, right? Like, 95% of crimes, 95% of police, you know, appearances when the police show up for a 911 call, it's not a violent crime. So why are you even bringing a gun? And I think that's what people mean. Like when people are saying defund the police. And I think that scares a lot of people because that makes a lot of people think, oh, we're not going to be safe. But really, I think with defund the police, a lot of it is like completely retrain the police, you know, rewrite the practices. Like, why do you have a gun? Why do you need a gun in a situation like that? And, you know, like, and there's a ton of stuff, but, and I think a lot of the conversation now needs to transfer from, okay, stop hating black people, because there is a people who hate black people for no reason other than they're just racist. But I think like 90% of people, probably they, if you ask them and if they're being honest, like they don't hate black people, but they have some kind of implicit something. And when you mix that with the police and the way that they operate and the way that they're trained and the procedures they have, like those are the conversations we need to have now. We kind of have to enter a second phase of this where we're like, okay, well, what tangible steps can we take, you know, from a practical, political and, you know, police academy perspective. You know, it's not enough to be like, I don't hate black people. Well, it's like, that's okay, but that's cool. But like, what are we doing to actively make the situation better?
Yeah, so I totally agree.
And it's a long journey, man. And it's honestly, it starts with education to me. I think, you know, because I think obviously racism is taught, but it's taught at a young age. And it's taught so subtly that it's like a lot of people don't actually know that they're racist. I truly believe that. Especially in my hometown. Like I grew up with a lot of these kids and I see them, like some of them that are still, you know what I mean, in the 30% that are against, you know, Black Lives Matter and things like that. But just, I've grown up with these kids and they truly don't know because they've never been outside of York, PA. They've never even been to York City before. You know what I mean? So they've never had to walk in those shoes. You know what I mean? And they've never had to experience anything outside of what they've been taught, you know, in their rural, you know what I mean, area that they've grown up in, so that the racism is so deeply rooted. Because you think about it, like the entire history that you're taught growing up is so whitewashed that you're literally taught white supremacy. They taught you Christopher Columbus was a hero and gave you a holiday for him. They taught you George Washington was a hero. Even Thomas Jefferson, like they idolized these guys, and they were criminals. You know what I mean? Like they were some of the worst people ever. Our founding fathers, like you mentioned earlier, it wasn't written for us. These people were awful. But your history books don't tell you that because they kind of have, I mean, they think that they're doing kids a favor. No, you're teaching them white supremacy. You're teaching them that, you know, that they are the more dominant race and they don't even know it. So they grow up, you know, with this deep hatred of black people at being considered equal to them because it's a threat to the privilege that they've been taught to have their entire lives. And they don't even know it. So it's like, it's really hard to educate those people. That's something that I think that's something that needs to be taught from grade school. Teach the real history of these people and talk about them in the real light that they should be. And I think that's when you will see monumental. And I think that's why our generation is kind of leading this movement. You know what I mean? Of younger people, because we got the internet, you know what I mean? We grew up with the internet. So like, okay, we learned this in school, but hold on. You know what I mean? Like I got the opportunity to leave. I went to college, I got educated and I'm like, hold on, this is different. You know what I mean? You know, now there's more, you know, there's more black fathers in their lives than it used to be, who teach them the real history of what happened and things like that. And then you get to educate your white friends now, because I went to a public white, most predominantly white high school. You know what I mean? And a lot of the kids that I grew up with now are allies to me. So, you know what I mean? So it's like, I got, because they shared that experience with me, they got to know somebody who understands the plight. Now they understand it. And that's where that growth is going to happen, you know, and you're going to have the people that are stuck in their ways, of course, but you know, the conversation just needs to keep going, because the more we further it, you know what I mean? The better things eventually we'll get, but we also have to take the action steps, you know what I mean? As far as voting and taking care of our money and things like that, to eradicate everything that's been done.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, just, you know, representative of the black community as a people, we have to do better too. You know, everybody understands the oppression, 400 years, all that. We understand that stuff. But at the same time, people in the African American community, people of color, Hispanic, you know, you have to come together as a people too. Yes, oppression is real. You know, especially this pandemic exposed me to a lot of things. You know, just seeing what students are going through. You know, but we definitely have to, you know, find a way to improve as a people. Take education serious. Don't look like, I sometimes look at, like, you know, when the new Jordans come out, for example, okay? And, you know, some of my students, hey, I need you to get a notebook, make sure you have your book bag, pencil, pens, paper, whatever. Cool, okay? Put on the syllabus, all right? You come to class week two, you still don't have your stuff. Where's it at? Oh, I can't get to the store. But I look down at your feet, and you got the brand new pair of J's on. You got the nice Gucci belt. You got the iPhone 11. I said, see, this is where we got to shift the focus. It's not about the materialistic things. The materialistic things are going to come. You're going to look, you know, you're going to look good. I know you understand you want to go to school and be, you know, what is it, you know, handsome and wealthy, you know, bad and bougie, you know.
All the drip.
At the same time, you got to be, you need to be dripped in your education, because at the end of the day, if you're not educated, if you don't understand education, if you don't learn from the past, then you're going to be swimming up creek in the future, because you don't have that common knowledge, that common sense, you know, how to handle certain situations, because you were so worried about the drip, whereas you weren't applying yourself to the books and educating yourself, you know. And yet, slavery has a traumatic experience on people of color still to this day. There's a systematic, traumatic experience, you know, that's just naturally embedded in us, you know. From years past, but at the same time, there's also been opportunities that we got to take advantage of, and education is definitely one. That's why I got into this field. I said, you know what, I might as well, you know, give what God gave me, use my knowledge, and try to influence somebody, even if it's just one student. If I know if I got one, I'm good. But you know, obviously, you want to please everybody and help everybody, but that's why I think we also got to get better too. You know, as a people, is, you know. You know, get, you know, educating ourselves, and, you know, realizing that there's more to life than what's been presented, and also uniting. Everybody united. That Black Lives Matter movement, it was nice to see, you know, white people, Hispanic, you know, that was cool to see that, you know. So times are changing. There might be some white people who were marching there whose ancestors would not agree with them marching in the Black Lives Matter, but they're now the generation, like you said, the generation now, It's totally different from, hell, I graduated high school in 2007. And this generation that I'm teaching now is way different. We were just now getting into the iPhones and the iPod Touch there. You know what I'm saying? So, and I thought that was the baddest thing in the world. Now it's iPhone 11, it's the MacBook Pro, you know. I mean, there's so much hands-on resources that these people, that these kids have, and that these people that we have now that we didn't have back then. Because, like, could you imagine if we had cell phones like we and the technology we had back then? We might have been we might have missed out on a lot of police brutality instances. Yeah. You know, they showed Rodney King, but that wasn't by cell phone recording. That was by a news camera. You know.
Yeah.
So just imagine the Rodney Kings leading up to that, and the Freddie Grays leading up to that.
Right.
With modern technology. So
yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap.
Thank y'all. Thank you.
Yeah, man. We appreciate you coming on the show again, man. Truly want to thank you for coming out and taking some time with us to talk about, you know, your life, your career, things like that. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, man. Thank you for having me, man. And Mike, it's good meeting you, man. It's real good.
Absolutely.
Meeting you. Keep doing what you're doing. You guys have like a link I can, or I see it. Is that your King ING?
That's my Twitter. Yeah, that's Twitter. Yeah.
I'm gonna follow you. Okay.
Okay. Cool.
Do I follow you on Twitter? I think I do.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Okay. I'm gonna follow you guys, man. I appreciate it, man. This was great.
Yeah. Yeah. You were awesome, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. No problem.
All righty.
Have a good one. All right. Well, again, thank you to Richard Baldrow coming on, being a guest with us, talking about some football and talking about his career. We appreciate him. And thank you guys again for tuning in to another episode of the All In Podcast. For those of you tuning in on YouTube, go ahead, leave a like, comment, make sure you subscribe to the channel. That way you get updates on when we release shows and things like that. Mike, you want to talk a little bit about what we got going on the website?
Yeah, so the website allinnetwork.net, we have posted, we're kind of kicking things up on there more often than we were. So we're doing baseball stuff, National League, American League previews. Eli has started his series on redrafting each NBA draft from 2010 to 2019. So you want to check those out. Allinnetwork.net, you can find that link in the video description here. You can go to our page and find it there. You follow us on Twitter @all_in_pod. And make sure, if you haven't checked out the Reign and Bliss podcast yet on this same YouTube feed, they have their own audio on Apple and Spotify. Follow them. They're hilarious. And definitely, you know, you want to follow them if you want to know what women are thinking.
Yeah. New episode of theirs, which is their fourth episode, not counting our previous joint podcast, is up now, just dropped on Tuesday. So make sure you guys go check that out on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else where you get your podcasts. And again, thank you guys for going all in with us. This episode is brought to you by Tavon's Lawn Care and the All In Network. Thank you guys again. Have a great night.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks.